8:30 a.m. Sandpoint, K201DA, King Cove, KFPS, False Pass.
When civilians are being killed left and right, that's a problem if the hospital's abilities are further degraded.
A week has passed since Israel shattered a ceasefire that many had hoped would help end the war in Gaza.
For Monday, March 24th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Trump administration continues to test the limits of the judicial system as a check on executive power.
They're not willing to let the judiciary and these processes just play out.
Also, federal agencies are forcing workers back into the office, but that could compromise patient care at the VA.
And new research on how kangaroos can hop so efficiently.
A study focuses on the movements of a close cousin of the kangaroo.
Even at their fastest speed, they always stayed on four legs. They bounded along.
Those stories and more coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. U.S. and Russian negotiators met in the Saudi capital Riyadh today as efforts to reach a ceasefire between Kyiv and Moscow continue. However, even as the meeting was underway, a Russian missile strike damaged a school and hospital in Ukraine, injuring at least 88 people. NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow says Russia appears to be in no hurry to reach a deal.
There's this larger argument you hear in Moscow. Why compromise what the Kremlin seems to think it can take on the battlefield? So these temporary ceasefire proposals, whether they hold up or not, at least address two areas, oil facilities, gas facilities, and, say, attacks on naval ships, where Russia's remained vulnerable to Ukrainian attacks. Critics will say the Kremlin is now slow-walking on Trump's larger goal of a full ceasefire while Putin presses Russia's current military advantage. Meanwhile, he seems to be finding some sympathy in Washington for his larger goal, a neutered NATO presence near Russia's borders. But really, that can only come through negotiations with Trump. And the process itself, seems to restore Russia's stature as a global power on equal footing with the U.S.
NPR's Charles Maines. The head of the U.S. Postal Service is stepping down. As NPR's Hansi Luong reports, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy is leaving USPS weeks after Trump officials floated controversial ideas for taking over the independent mail agency.
In a statement, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy said he was planning to retire when he asked the Postal Service's governing board last month to start looking for someone to replace him. Since then, President Trump has confirmed his administration is considering having the Commerce Department take control of what Congress set up to be an independent postal service. Legal experts say that will likely violate federal law. DeJoy recently signed an agreement that allows Elon Musk's Doge team to find efficiencies at USPS. DeJoy was appointed to lead the Postal Service during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2021, he rolled out a 10-year reorganization plan in an attempt to bring financial stability to the postal system. Critics of the plan, however, say that consolidating mail processing centers and other changes have slowed service, especially in rural communities. Hansi Luong, NPR News, Washington.
The DNA testing company 23andMe is filing for bankruptcy. As NPR's Joe Hernandez explains, it comes after ongoing financial struggles at the company and raising questions about data privacy.
The biotech firm that allows users to spit in a tube and send away the sample for DNA analysis is seeking a buyer. It comes a few months after the California company laid off roughly 40% of its staff and 2 years after a data breach affected millions of customer accounts. Data privacy experts are now raising concerns about what could happen to the sensitive genetic information of 15 million users if 23andMe is sold. The company says customers can still delete their data and close their accounts if they choose, and has vowed to remain in operation through the bankruptcy process. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Stocks closed broadly higher on Wall Street today. The Dow up 597 points. The Nasdaq rose 404 points. This is NPR. A Georgia jury is ordering the parent company of Monsanto, Bayer, to pay nearly $2.1 billion in damages to a man who says the company's Roundup weed killer caused his cancer. Friday's verdict in the case marks the latest in a long-running series of court cases involving the company. The giant agrochemical firm says it plans to appeal. Lawyers for the individual said it includes roughly $65 million in compensatory damages and about $2 billion in punitive damages. Monsanto says jury awards are sometimes reduced, though, before judgments are finalized. A Netflix show about a young boy who kills a classmate has become a source of media fascination and fodder for debates and dismay over misogyny and the power of social media to radicalize boys and young men. More from NPR's Netta Ulaby.
The four-part series, Adolescence, follows a 13-year-old boy, the cops who arrest him, and his distraught family in a working-class British suburb.
You're making a big mistake! He's only a kid!
The show came out on March 13th. It's visually arresting. Each episode is filmed in one long shot. Its nuanced look at boys and their dads navigating contemporary masculinity even sparked a comment from the UK's Prime Minister, who said he watched it with his children. The show was co-created by one of its stars, Stephen Graham, who plays the father. While Adolescence has been viewed more than 24 million times, it's not what's most popular now on Netflix. That would be a movie with a million more views about a war between humans and robots. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Oil rose 83 cents a barrel to $69.11 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Tonight marks 1 week since Israel launched a blitz of airstrikes in Gaza that killed hundreds of people in the span of hours and shattered a ceasefire many had hoped would spell the end of the war. Joining us now to discuss the impact on the ground is NPR international correspondent Aya Bitrawi in Dubai. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, international journalists cannot get into Gaza, but you've been able to reach some American doctors who are volunteering there, and NPR's producer Anas Baba is there. Tell us what you've been hearing about the situation.
Well, Israel's been hitting a wide range of targets in Gaza for the past week. There's currently a crew of around 10 paramedics and civil defense rescue workers that have been missing for the past day. They were on their way to assist people fleeing the south of Gaza, where Israeli ground troops are advancing and thousands of people are fleeing on foot. And in the north, in Gaza City, this is what it sounded like last night from our producer's home there. So this was going on all night, and today Israeli airstrikes killed two journalists in separate attacks, including Hossam Shabat, a 23-year-old Al Jazeera correspondent. And last night, the military struck part of Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. This is one of the only functioning hospitals in that area.
What do we know about why Israel bombed that hospital?
Well, this stunning strike on this key hospital killed its intended target, and that was a senior political Hamas official that Israel says was using the hospital and its patients as human shields. Now, the attack destroyed the surgical ward, taking out critical bed space capacity. Dr. Feroz Sidwa is an American volunteer trauma surgeon in Gaza with MedGlobal, who was in Nasser Hospital when it was struck, and he sent me this voice memo after.
I mean, if you blow up part of a hospital, it doesn't work anymore. So we can't do as much as we could before. And when civilians are being killed left and right, including in their hospital bed, that's a problem if the hospital's abilities are further degraded.
So the attack not only killed the senior Hamas official Israel was targeting, but also his nephew, who was Dr. Sidwa's patient, a 16-year-old named Ibrahim. He tells me the boy was about to be discharged after removing shrapnel from his colon from an Israeli airstrike on a tent area he was in.
He did very well after the operation. He's kind of a spunky kid. He's one of those teenage boys that loves to tell you the opposite of whatever you're expecting to hear.
These latest attacks by Israel have pushed the confirmed death toll in Gaza to more than 50,000 people since the war began in October 2023. That is according to Gaza's health ministry. What do we know about who's been killed more broadly?
Well, the health ministry today released the list of names it has recorded so far. with their Palestinian ID numbers, their ages, their gender. This is a single space list of names of people killed. It is 1,516 pages long. And Juana, just the first 27 pages are listed as children under 1 year old. Now, the health ministry says around 270 of the kids on their list are babies who were born in this war and died in this war. But the total number under 18 who were killed, according to just the list of names they've recorded, is more than 15,600 in Gaza. Now, the health ministry does not give a breakdown of the number of militants among the dead, but it says that more than half of all those killed are women and children.
The UN today is reducing its footprint in Gaza, even as the humanitarian needs there are soaring. What does that decision mean for the people who are there in Gaza who are relying on aid for survival?
Well, right now, nothing has entered Gaza. No food, fuel, tents for people to live in, medical supplies. For more than 3 weeks, Israel has imposed this blockade to pressure Hamas to release more Israeli hostages that it's holding without agreeing to Hamas's demand of ending the war. So what the UN Secretary General is saying today is that the UN is not leaving Gaza, but that with no aid entering and aid workers being killed among those targeted, the risk to UN staff has become intolerable.
That is NPR's Aya Betrawi. Thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump is going to battle against the judicial system and against the critics who argue that he is denying immigrants due process. Trump is betting that Americans care more about removing gang members than whether they get a by-the-book court hearing. NPR's Franco Ordonez has this story on how Trump is picking favored political issues to test the U.S. system of checks and balances.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be with you.
Last week, President Trump spent days attacking the judge who tried to stop him from deporting members of a Venezuelan gang, Tren de Aragua, and other migrants. He laid out why he felt the various fights he's having with the judicial branch help him more than hurt him.
I just can't imagine that the Democrats are taking this issue where they want to have them back. You know, so now they have men playing in women's sports. They have transgender for everyone. They have open borders. They have all of their crazy policies that or I think 95-5, not 90-10, okay? And their new policy is, let's bring Tren de Aragua back into our country. Let's bring the worst, these are the worst gang members there are.
Trump and his team have no intention of allowing these cases to only play out in the courts. Instead, they're driving headlines. His spokesman, Harrison Fields, tells NPR that Trump is, quote, delivering on the common sense policies that helped him win the election. And that, quote, leftist judges shouldn't stand in the way. It's a strategy that one veteran Republican strategist compared to a matador waving a red cape of a provocative political issue. Doug High says Trump knows very well that all of Washington and the press will follow him like a charging bull.
Well, there are legal proceedings, and then there's the politics to this. And the politics are the rhetoric that we hear from Trump. That's what drives the attention.
He says by constantly churning out aggressive rhetoric, Trump is able to set the parameters of the debate so that Democrats and the media are responding to him and not the other way around.
In politics, you always want to be talking about what you want to talk about and have your opponent talk about what you want to talk about.
Legal cases move slowly and can be boring. They often hinge on complexities the ordinary public doesn't care about or understand. Sandy Moyer is the chairwoman of the Republican National Hispanic Assembly of North Carolina. She says Trump knows what the public does care about.
They want to be able to be safe in their own neighborhoods.
She says her neighbors worry about, quote, activist judges encouraging other judges to make questionable rulings that will make it harder for Trump.
There is a concern that, all right, is this going to delay this issue that we want to see swiftly being handled?
The White House says it's going to obey court orders, and they're confident they're ultimately going to win the court cases, and there are a lot of them. Trump has also attacked the judiciary for hampering his efforts to cut the federal workforce. This weekend, Trump's defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, criticized the judge who blocked an executive order banning transgender people from serving in the military. John McHenry, a Republican pollster with North Star Opinion Research, says it makes sense that Trump and his team are picking these specific issues to go public.
So when you're picking the fight, you're essentially fighting from your safest ground.
McHenry says reasonable people may disagree about immigration and who should be allowed to remain in the country. But Trump is making this about deporting criminals.
It's harder for the other side to argue it on the point of, no, you shouldn't be deporting gang members. Well, 80% of Americans probably do think you should be deporting gang members as quickly as possible, and they don't really care about any constitutional rights or separation of powers between, you know, the presidency and the judicial.
The administration has given little evidence that the deportees even are gang members. But Jenny Stromer-Galley, who studies political messaging at Syracuse University, says if Trump and his surrogates allow the lawyers to start telling the story, they lose the message.
The Trump administration wants the fight with the judicial branch.
She says it's about reinforcing Trump's image that only he, a strong executive, can cut through the gridlock of Congress and the judiciary.
They're not willing to let the judiciary and these processes just play out, because then to some degree they're acknowledging that the judiciary could be a check on the executive branch's power.
Which, she says, appears to be the only constraint on the president's power, since the Republican-led Congress appears to have deferred to Trump's authority. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Lots of people these days spend time in online meetings using platforms like Zoom or Microsoft Teams. People often pay attention to how they look in these video meetings, but as NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports, one scientist recently started paying attention to how people sound.
Cognitive scientist Brian Scholl is at Yale University. He says during the pandemic, faculty meetings suddenly became online virtual events. And one time, when a contentious issue was being discussed, two different faculty members spoke up.
One of them was an especially close collaborator. We almost always see eye to eye. He happened to be participating on Zoom using the microphone of an older, not so hot laptop.
It made his voice sound far away, tinny.
And I just sort of noticed that his comments didn't seem quite so compelling as I thought they usually did.
The other colleague, someone Scholl respects but often disagrees with, was participating from his home recording studio using fancy audio equipment. His voice sounded rich, resonant.
I kept thinking, wow, yeah, he seems right about that. His contributions just seem somehow more profound.
It made him wonder if microphone quality was having subtle effects on people's perceptions. So he designed a study to test this. He worked with lab members Robert Walter and Joan Anchaco to create recordings of people speaking in various contexts. Here's one from a job interview scenario.
After 8 years in sales, I am currently seeking a new challenge.
Then they made lower quality versions of these recordings.
After 8 years in sales, I am currently seeking a new challenge.
An online research tool let the scientists play these recordings to hundreds of different people.
What we did is we had each person listen to just a single recording.
Afterwards, the listener got asked questions like, would you hire this person? Do they seem believable?
In basically every case we looked at, there was a pretty surprising, pretty substantial difference.
In the case of the job interview, for example, people were more likely to want to hire a speaker when the audio quality was better. High quality audio made the speaker seem more attractive, believable, convincing. The results are in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Scholl says you might want to ask a colleague to record how you sound in online meetings, because how you're coming across to others might surprise you. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. 2 days of negotiations in Saudi Arabia over a ceasefire and the war in Ukraine have ended without a signed deal. And Russia and Ukraine don't even seem to agree over the terms of a limited 30-day ceasefire that each side already committed to in principle last week. It's a measure of just how little trust there is in the relationship. One big reason for that is a long string of agreements broken by Russia. Serhii Plahy is a historian at Harvard University, and I asked him to walk through it, starting with a 1994 agreement called the Budapest Memorandum, signed just a few years after Ukraine declared independence from the Soviet Union.
So once the Soviet Union fell apart, the huge Soviet nuclear arsenal ended up to be stationed on the territory of now four independent states. And Ukraine inherited the biggest chunk of that aside from Russia. So what happened in Budapest in 1994, and at that time the president of the United States was Bill Clinton, was that Ukraine and other states that inherited Soviet nuclear arsenal were provided with assurances for their territorial integrity and for their security in exchange for turning the nuclear weapons to Russia. And United States played a very important role in that negotiation. So Ukrainians were extremely concerned at that time. The nuclear weapons was the only deterrent that they had against Russia. That was happening at the time when Russia was making claims for Ukrainian territory. So Ukraine found itself in an impossible situation and had to agree to the deal.
And of course, we know that that agreement, the Budapest Memorandum, did not end up protecting Ukraine. In 2014, Russia invaded and annexed Crimea, part of Ukraine, which brings us to another Russia-Ukraine deal, the Minsk agreements. Tell us what those laid out.
The annexation of the Crimea really became an opening stage for the war between Russia and Ukraine, because the next move that Russia did, they were trying also to annex the eastern part of Ukraine called Donbas. A few weeks after the fighting, the first Minsk agreements were reached, which was a sort of the armistice at that time. And what happened was, after Minsk won, Russia decided that it was not really satisfied with the amount of territory that it had and the conditions that it imposed on Ukraine. So they resumed the military action in early 2015 and then led to Minsk II, which was more in alliance with their original plans. So we have the story of armistice agreements that was signed and violated again and again by the Russian Federation. People are concerned that that can happen again.
What lessons do you think Ukraine takes away from this history of broken promises as they are potentially heading towards another agreement with Russia?
One thing is that there is a belief that giving up nuclear weapons back in 1994 was a major mistake, that Russia is treated the way it is treated, not because it is somehow economic powerhouse, but mostly it is treated that way because it is a nuclear superpower. So the nuclear weapons is the real deterrent. The solution for Ukraine was perceived for a long period of time, was viewed in membership in NATO. That's why President Zelensky was keeping talking about NATO again and again and again.
Right.
Now it doesn't look this is possible at all. So for Zelensky, for Ukraine, the alliance, continuing alliance with the United States, is extremely important. And that alliance is extremely important also for Europe, for stopping Russian aggression. And it is important for the United States of America. Because if U.S. leaves, the vacuum will be filled, and it's not given that the alliance that Ukraine will sign will be necessarily with Europe. It can be China as well.
Ukraine is now in a position of negotiating with the same two countries that left it without its nuclear deterrent 30 years ago. I'm talking, of course, about the U.S. and Russia. We've talked so much about the geopolitics of the situation, but I want to ask you about the people. How do people in Ukraine feel about being back in this position again, decades later?
Well, there is a huge concern and huge disappointment. The United States was perceived, despite Budapest Memorandum, as really a flag bearer of democracy and of just peace. There was belief that there was also a level of democratic solidarity in the world. People in Ukraine now realize that it is not there, or at least it is not on the level that they believed it was. So, huge disappointment, cynicism, the realization, okay, there is no one else but yourself to count on.
We've been speaking with Serhii Plahi. He's director of the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome, Vera. Thank you.
Hopping has evolved multiple times in the animal kingdom. Think grasshoppers, frogs, rabbits. But maybe the bounciest of the group would be kangaroos, which can hop and hop and hop with amazing efficiency, right?
As they go faster, they don't actually use any extra energy. They essentially use the same amount of energy regardless of how fast they're hopping.
Peter Bishop of Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology says scientists know a bit about how that works.
Kangaroos have very long hind limbs, very long legs, and they have very, very long tendons. And so they're essentially bouncing along on a set of like rubber bands, almost, very elastic. So they can bounce and recoil and recover a lot of that energy from step to step.
But a bigger question is how kangaroo's superpower came to be. To investigate, Bishop and his colleagues turned to a sort of evolutionary second cousin of the kangaroo, a rat-looking creature called the musky rat kangaroo.
It's kind of stocky, small, forages about in the tropical rainforests. Doesn't look a thing like what you would typically associate with a kangaroo. It's not large, lanky, bouncing about on these two very long hind legs.
No, in fact, it is not known to hop on its hind legs at all, which is why they wanted to study it, to see if this pudgy brown critter might hold clues about how proto-kangaroos moved.
Huh. So to study the tiny roo, the researchers set up cameras in the rainforests of northern Australia and filmed the animals kind of scurrying around. Then they used software to analyze the videos, deconstructing the musky rat kangaroo's gait frame by frame, and they found...
Even at their fastest speed, they always stayed on four legs. They bounded along.
And the way they bounded along was revealing.
As they move, their hind limbs always move together as a pair. And that is telling us that that could be a precursor to the bipedal kangaroos because they also move their hind limbs in pairs.
The findings appear in the journal Australian Mammalogy. Bishop says the work gives scientists insights into how kangaroo hopping might have evolved, and perhaps new ideas as well for robots or prosthetic devices based on jumpers like the kangaroo.
They've been figuring out essentially the same kinds of problems that engineers and roboticists are trying to work out.
But the animals have already got a huge jump, get it, on human technologists by tens of millions of years.
This is NPR News.
We're inside a Chinese restaurant, or as it would be known here in Beijing, a restaurant. We're reporting from here, and on the next morning edition, we will hear what a Chinese scholar thinks about Donald Trump's America. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration wants federal workers back in the office. Some therapists at the Department of Veterans Affairs say that could compromise patient privacy.
What we've heard is there's not even enough room for each person to come in one day a week, let alone 5 days a week.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Efforts by the Trump White House to reshape the Social Security Administration is raising concerns among beneficiaries and advocates. As NPR's Windsor Johnson tells us, a hearing on Capitol Hill tomorrow will feature Trump's pick to lead the agency.
Social Security recipients say they're worried about the Trump administration's decision to grant Elon Musk and his government efficiency team extensive access to the agency's databases. The White House says the move is part of an effort to identify and eliminate fraud within the agency. In the meantime, Frank Bisignano, the CEO of a private tech firm, will go before the Senate Finance Committee on Tuesday. He was tapped by President Trump to be the next commissioner of Social Security. Opponents of his nomination cite his lack of prior government experience. Supporters argue that his business acumen could be beneficial in addressing Social Security's financial challenges. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump announced a 25% tariff on any country that buys oil or gas from Venezuela. In a social media post, Trump called this a secondary tariff that will go into effect on April 2nd. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has more.
Trump said countries buying the oil and gas would pay the tariff. This is not how tariffs work. An American tariff would be paid by a company in America importing foreign goods. The reason for the new tariff, Trump wrote, is violent immigrants from Venezuela. Trump claims, without evidence, that the Venezuelan government purposely sent criminals to the U.S. Multiple studies show no link between immigration and violent crime. On April 2nd, when this new tariff goes into effect, Trump also plans what he calls reciprocal tariffs on countries around the world. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Well, stocks finished broadly higher on Wall Street today. This is NPR. The U.S. and the Philippines kick off major military drills near Manila this week, convening to practice wartime readiness skills together and test out the U.S.-Philippines relationship under President Trump. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
The Philippines is one of the U.S.'s main allies in the Pacific region. And in the last 4 years, Manila has aggressively pushed back against Chinese territorial claims in the waters around the Philippines. The Philippines has let the U.S. expand military bases there and held more joint military exercises. Yet, under the Trump administration, the U.S. has emphasized a foreign policy that reduces commitments abroad and relies less on alliances. This week's drills, the Philippines said, were to showcase what it called a, quote, strong bilateral commitment with the U.S. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is scheduled to travel to Manila at the end of this week. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
Well, the nation's first black Republican congresswoman, Mia Love, has died from an aggressive brain cancer. She was 49 years old. A reliable conservative, she was born in New York and raised in Connecticut. Love moved to Utah in the 1990s and eventually served in Congress for 2 terms. She didn't shy away from criticizing President Trump during his first term after he used offensive language to describe Haiti and other developing countries in Africa. On Wall Street, stocks finished broadly higher to end the day. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Race and politics were front and center at the Supreme Court today. The justices took up a voting rights case involving Louisiana's congressional redistricting after the 2020 census. As NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports, the case is nearly identical to a case from Alabama, which the Supreme Court ruled on 2 years ago.
Louisiana's population is roughly 30% black, but after the census, the state legislature drew new congressional district lines that provided for only one majority black district in a state that has six congressional seats. That's the same thing Alabama did after the census, only to be slapped down by the Supreme Court 2 years ago when a narrow court majority ruled that the state had illegally diluted the black vote in violation of the Voting Rights Act. There's one difference between the Alabama and Louisiana cases. Alabama did not create a second black district until ordered to do so by the Supreme Court. In Louisiana, the state legislature, after losing before multiple courts, saw the handwriting on the wall and drew a new map that provided for a second majority black district. But that new district was challenged by a group of Louisiana citizens identifying themselves as, quote, non-African American voters. They lost in the lower courts and appealed to the Supreme Court, which heard arguments in the case today. First to the lectern was Benjamin Agunaga, representing the state. He told the justices that the legislature, faced with the prospect of federal judges drawing new district lines for congressional seats, bit the bullet and itself drew a new map with a second majority-minority district. Agunaga noted that the alternative map would have put key Republicans in jeopardy, including House Speaker Mike Johnson and Majority Leader Steve Scalise.
It's an election year. We're talking about the Speaker of the House. No rational state gambles with those high-stakes seats in that situation.
Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the court's opinion in the Alabama case requiring a second majority black district, seems skeptical about the Louisiana map because it created less compact districts than were drawn in Alabama.
What if they didn't talk about politics, just said, we're doing this because of race, we don't like that other map, race, race, race.
Lawyer Stuart Nafee, representing the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, replied that the original map proposed by civil rights groups was more compact, but that the groups ultimately agreed to the legislature's compromise, which protected incumbents. Supposing, asked Justice Barrett, that there was no incumbency justification here from the legislature.
You think the drawing of this district was not predominantly based on race? It's a snake that runs from one end of the state to the other. I mean, how is that compact?
The last of today's lawyers, Edward Grime, representing the, quote, non-black plaintiffs, faced this question from Justice Kagan.
What was Louisiana supposed to do? So, like, at a certain point, there might have been other options, but that's the whole point about breathing room, right? Breathing room is states have choices. And this was one state that decided on this choice that you don't agree with, but it was, like, well within the parameters of a good faith, reasonable choice.
Although today all six of the court's conservatives expressed serious doubts about the state legislature's map, the fact is that just 2 years ago, the same six sounded equally skeptical about the Alabama redistricting map that the justices subsequently upheld as required under the Voting Rights Act. So, reading the tea leaves from today's argument is a bit of a fool's errand. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Employees at federal agencies who work remotely are being called back into the office under the Trump administration. At the Department of Veterans Affairs, some doctors and therapists are concerned that this change will compromise their patients' privacy. NPR's Kadia Riddle reports.
conversations between doctors and patients can get quite personal. That's true at the VA as much as any medical facility.
There's a lot of talk about sexual health and what are people doing in their sex lives.
This woman is a physician at the VA. She asked that we only use her middle name, Paige. She's afraid of losing her job for speaking out. She says there are a lot of different kinds of clinicians throughout the agency that need to regularly have these delicate conversations with patients.
Those are not things that any of us want to talk about with another person nearby.
Many VA clinicians all over the country were hired on a telehealth basis. It's a way to expand VA healthcare and especially helpful for reaching rural areas. Therapists say there simply is not enough private space in VA buildings to have confidential sessions. This woman is a mental health clinician at the VA. She asked to be identified by an initial, H, for fear of being fired for speaking out.
What we've heard is there's not even enough room for each person to come in one day a week, let alone 5 days a week.
H says she and her team have all been instructed to prepare to return to work in person instead of doing telehealth from home. However, in many instances, they will still be doing telehealth just from a shared office space.
We've been told that they're cleaning out closets. They're looking into trying to purchase headsets.
Even with the best headsets in the world, she says, there is no way to conduct productive therapy sessions from an open space. This is not just an ethical question. It's also a legal one. That's because of a federal law known as HIPAA that protects patient privacy.
People need to know that they have privacy and confidentiality, both from a HIPAA standpoint, but in order to do high-quality psychotherapy work, both parties need to be fully concentrated and not worried about censoring themselves.
Some say this policy change is not in line with the ethos of the agency. Kayla Williams is a senior policy advisor for an organization called Vote Vets.
Unfortunately, the emphasis in this current moment does not seem to be on providing that highest quality care, but figuring out ways to cut the size of the department.
The VA has cut hundreds of positions and are looking to cut tens of thousands more. Williams says between the back to work order and these cuts, people there are dispirited.
I hear from someone almost every day who tells me that they and their colleagues are crying.
In an email response to this story, VA spokesperson Peter Kasparowitz called the concern around HIPAA compliance, quote, nonsensical, and said, quote, VA is no longer a place where the status quo for employees is to simply phone it in from home. He went on to say VA would make space accommodations in order to ensure veterans' access to care would remain uninterrupted and HIPAA compliant. These clinicians say they are not reassured and are concerned they will lose a lot of colleagues. Here's H again.
That they simply will leave the VA because that's not a workable solution.
Some people are even worried they could lose their medical license for providing care in these conditions. They're drawing their own ethical red lines in their minds, balancing concern for themselves and their patients. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
This week, our colleague Steve Inskeep from Morning Edition is reporting from China, asking people there for their views on the world today. Tomorrow morning, we'll hear what one Chinese academic thinks as he watches the President of the United States team up with a tech billionaire to change how the U.S. government works.
So I will say this is very revolutionary. Of course, it could be a bad revolution. It could be a good revolution. I don't know. It's too early to judge.
That story tomorrow on Morning Edition.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We learn certain emotional truths through experience. We can be scared but still be okay. We can build resilience. We can let go of things. These lessons can take a lifetime to learn, but what if we could learn them at age 3, in a lullaby? One songwriter is creating music just like this, and as Dina Prishep reports, it's not just kids who are listening.
Michelle Barrow had her twins during the height of the pandemic, and as soon as they were born, she started singing to them.
My body is a good body, and it's the only one I'll ever know. So I treat it like a friend because my body is my home.
Barrow started posting these songs on TikTok and Instagram under the name Mama New. That's N-O-U-S, like the French word for us. The melodies are sweet and simple, but the ideas are pretty big.
Sometimes my brain's a bully. Sometimes it says really mean things. Sometimes about myself, sometimes somebody else, but my brain don't know everything.
Obviously, you have to be careful to frame your message in a way that makes it available and appropriate for kids, but they can really handle some really big topics, and they want to be talking about and exploring really big topics.
I am not my thoughts, and I choose to listen to my heart.
Barrow records out of her home studio and has never given a Mama New concert, unless you count her kids' preschool. But she's reached millions through social media. Signa Holly Murray's family listens to Mama New songs every morning.
The one that got us hooked was Worrying's Never Changed a Thing.
Worrying has never changed a thing. And so all that I can do is try to bring a sense of steady calm till I know what's going on. 'Cause worrying has never changed a thing.
Holly Murray says it's given their six-year-old the language to understand feelings about big changes, like starting kindergarten. That helps her regulate, not only herself, but the whole family.
My daughter one time like stopped me in the car and was like, Mama, I was like rushing out the door and was like, Mama, worrying and rushing isn't going to change a thing. And I turned around and I started laughing because I was like, oh my gosh, it's so true.
Mama News posts don't just resonate with kids. They're full of comments from adults who talk about how much these children's songs have helped them process their own emotions.
What I was taught was to stuff it down, you know, to ignore it or to just get over it.
Jeff Syria doesn't even have young kids, but he says hearing these songs has helped him kind of reparent himself.
In the dark, you can listen to your whispering heart. Close your eyes, pay attention to your body.
At some point, we hit a certain age where we decide that we are supposed to have it all figured out. And I just don't ever think that that's true. I think we're all fumbling and figuring it out as we go along.
Through Mama New, Michelle Barrow hopes that hearing these messages, especially sung to a catchy tune, can help people figure things out and grow up to be their best, loving selves at any age. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
Sometimes my brain's a bully. Sometimes it says really mean things. Sometimes about myself, sometimes somebody else, but my...
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A warning, this conversation covers the topic of sexual assault. At the age of 33, Amanda Nguyen has a string of accolades that most people will never collect over the course of their entire lives. Nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, Time Woman of the Year, Forbes 30 Under 30. She's also said to become the first Vietnamese-American woman ever to fly into space. It's a breathtaking streak of peaks, especially considering the depths she has traveled. In 2013, Amanda was raped during her senior year at Harvard, just months before graduating. She had plans to work at NASA or at the CIA, but those plans were immediately derailed after she realized that Massachusetts state law would permit the destruction of her rape kit within 6 months. So Amanda would go on to change the law, not only in Massachusetts, but across the country, to ensure that survivors of sexual assault have the right to have their rape kit evidence preserved for the entire length of the statute of limitations. She details her story in her new book, Saving Five, A Memoir of Hope, and joins us now. Amanda, thank you so much for coming in today to talk to me.
Thank you for having me.
When you were assaulted at Harvard in 2013, can I just ask, why did you choose to submit what's called a Jane Doe rape kit instead of attaching your real name to the physical evidence that was collected from your body?
It was fear. You know, I was about to graduate. I felt like I had worked my entire life to have a future ahead of me. And I also knew that the career choices I wanted to go to, NASA or intelligence agencies, was one that looked into people's backgrounds. You have to pass security checks.
Sure.
And if I were to have a court case that was open, that would be used against me. That would be held against me.
You knew that or you suspected that?
I knew that because I had worked in the White House as an intern before. And part of the application process is a security clearance form that you have to fill out. Mm-hmm. And that does ask you to list if you have any active court cases. And so already the systems that are built around us disincentivize victims, disincentivize survivors from pursuing their justice. Even when I had my first conversation with legal professionals, they were well-intentioned. And so they told me what the reality is. Mm-hmm. They said, you know, court cases often take years. They told me that it's a 1% conviction rate. So was I prepared to go through that? It was devastating to hear that. Mm-hmm. And so I chose to delay my justice because I wanted to fight for my career, for my dreams.
Absolutely. But just so people understand, by not assigning your name to the evidence at first, that meant your rape kit would be destroyed under Massachusetts state law after 6 months, unless you kept on extending that timeline
yes.
every 6 months, mm-hmm. even though the statute of limitations for rape in Massachusetts is 15 years, right?
That's right, yes. And it would be destroyed untested, which meant that even if I, as a survivor, had gone to the police, had gone to the hospital, and had done the things that people tell survivors to do, mm-hmm. we could still lose the evidence untested. And I actually found out when I started sharing my story publicly that this was an experience survivors all across the United States were experiencing, and oftentimes also experiencing other things that were very unfair. So for instance, in New York State, before my law passed there, rape kits were destroyed at 30 days. Justice should not depend on geography. Had I been raped in another state that had protections, then I wouldn't have to go through this. And what I felt was truly Kafkaesque was the fact that there was no standardized way of saving the rape kit. So even if they said, okay, well, at 6 months, you still want to renew, there was no way to renew it. I had to track down exactly where my rape kit was, where
right.
the DNA evidence from my body was taken, and then persuade the forensics lab to keep it.
And what did it feel like to live under a constantly ticking clock at that point?
Yeah.
Like, as you put it, acknowledging every half birthday of your rape kit.
Yeah, it was devastating. It felt like my entire life stopped, and the only thing that I could hear was this thunderous ticking of the second hand. Every single moment that my kit wasn't extended, it would be 1 second more towards the destruction of my evidence.
Well, you set out to change the law, and it was striking to me that the U.S. Congress turned out to be the faster body to get a new law passed than the Massachusetts state legislature.
Yeah.
Who would have figured?
Yeah.
It was your first time talking to lawmakers when you were doing this. I have never lobbied for anything in my life before. What was it like to take this incredibly painful, traumatic experience and to share it over and over again as a part of a set of talking points to lawmakers? Did that change the way you personally processed what happened to you?
100%. In the beginning, when I started advocating for my own rights, I hid my story as a survivor. And I wanted it to be for the merit of the issue, the legal precedents, the statistics. And when I talked to these staffers, they just wouldn't look up from their BlackBerries. And I figured, okay, well, I needed to tell them that this isn't only an issue in theory, that I am a rape survivor sitting in front of them. This happened to me. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I did share my survivor story, people would look up from their phones. And I realized, okay, well, I do need to be vulnerable and show that this is an issue that impacts a live human being right in front of them.
Yes. Your parents were both refugees from Vietnam. You detail in this book some extremely difficult moments during your childhood. Your father's violence towards you, his anger, and then his suggestion that you were partly to blame for your rape at one point. Does your father now see the enormity of what you accomplished in helping get this federal law passed?
You know, I will say that my parents were not happy when I had a Harvard degree and decided to go into activism. But they've come around after I was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize.
It only took that to get the Asian parents on board.
Exactly. Now, this is actually a conversation that I want to have, especially with folks in my community who I know often struggle with filial piety versus what they are called to, what their passions are. And so what I want to say is that your parents want you to be happy and healthy. They survived, and that's why their mind is trained in that survival mode.
Yes.
But you are the ultimate person that drives your life, and you have to survive for yourself.
Amanda Wynn's new book is called Saving Five, A Memoir of Hope. Thank you so much for coming in today and sharing this time with me.
Thank you.
I so appreciate you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the John D.
A time in my life. This story goes to tell you of a time in my life when nobody else cared for me. Everything was against me, no money, no wife, but just an old and a broken guitar. Oh yes, no one to assist me, no friends did come my way.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. and